Hey, Fall Line listeners. Sorry I sound a little scratchy today. I am getting over the flu. We're sharing another long interview with you, and we're breaking it into two parts. But no worries, because you won't have to wait a week to hear part two. We will release that tomorrow, on Thursday. This interview briefly mentions miscarriage, suicide, and neonatocide. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. Medico-legal professionals use a shorthand acronym, UID. That stands for Unidentified Decedent. The deceased our audience might think of as DOES. We spent a portion of our time here at The Fall Line covering unidentified decedent cases for a lot of reasons. There are many of them gone cold here in the United States, especially dating back to the 20th century before the advent of investigative genetic genealogy. Unidentified decedents are less likely to get coverage in mainstream media and on podcasts. After all, at least most of the time, there's no narrative waiting for storytellers to unwind. While there are usually family members out there waiting, families who had been or still are looking for their loved ones, we don't have their context to add to the stories as we do with the identified missing and murdered. So the trick is to try and tell a story anyway, through science and through scene, through the connection people have to each other, just as human beings. We want to form a connection between an audience and an unknown individual, even if they're just represented by a simple moniker like the Twiggs County John Doe or the Glynn County Jane Doe, the Beaufort County Jane Doe, Christmas Doe, the list goes on. We hope that if we do it right, you will remember them. You'll share the forensic reconstructions and the posters prepared by medical examiners or law enforcement. We hope the right person will see them. Including the unidentified victims of Samuel Little, we've covered 16 John and Jane Doe cases on The Fall Line. Since we began the show, three of those victims have been identified. Clara Birdlong, who was an unidentified Mississippi victim of Little, formerly known as the Pascagoula or LaFleur County Jane Doe. And there's Patricia Parker of Tennessee, who was known as the Dade County Jane Doe. She was also a Little victim. Then there's William Hamilton, a child found in DeKalb County, Georgia, who was known as Dennis Doe until this year. His mother has been charged with his homicide. In two of these identifications, investigative genetic genealogy was the key. In the third, DNA testing confirmed William's relationship with his mother. His case was actually solved through a tip. Our audience is well aware that forensic, or as many practitioners prefer, investigative genetic genealogy has changed the landscape of cold case resolution in the United States. It's hard to believe that it's been a little over 5 years since those solves began, because it seems like there's a new headline every day, like it's been going on forever. The earliest practitioners of investigative genetic genealogy were genealogists like Barbara Ray Venter, C.C. Moore, Margaret Press, Colleen Fitzpatrick, and others who gathered on message boards and recognized the incredible tool offered by the first generation of at-home DNA tests. Now, for-profit and non-profit organizations, labs, genealogy companies, and some that offer both, have sprung up to fill the forensic needs of both active and cold cases. Some handle both perpetrator and unidentified persons cases, and others, like the DNA Doe Project, focus solely on unknown decedents. DNA Doe Project is a nonprofit founded in 2017 by Margaret Press and Colleen Fitzpatrick. Colleen exited a few years ago to focus on her company, Identifinders, and Margaret has continued DDP's work with a staff of five and a pool of volunteer genetic genealogists that has grown to roughly 80. They may be victims of crime or dead by any other cause. DDP, as the organization is known in forensic circles, will take on their case as long as it meets their parameters. Cases need to be brought to them. They don't contact medico-legal officials to request cases. Also, They only work on unidentified decedent cases, not perpetrator cases. They don't take on neonaticides or newborn cases. More on that when we get into the interview. Their team has solved very high-profile cases. There's Joseph Newton Chandler III, a famous John Doe whose use of a deceased child's name as his alias was only discovered after his suicide in 2002. DDP's identification of him as Robert Ivan Nickel was announced in June 2018. Lyle Stevick, another pseudonymous case we've discussed on the podcast before, was also identified by DDP in 2018. In that case, the family has chosen to keep the deceased's identity private. Those are just a few of the high-profile cases solved by DDP, and importantly, they take on cases that aren't about raising their profile too, cases that simply need solving. Many of those decedents come from regions where limited resources mean that testing would never have been an option for medical examiners or departments. But DDP has worked toward a solution for that. DDP's fundraising efforts are described on their website this way, quote, "We raise funds to provide the supervision, tools, and infrastructure our volunteers need to do their work and to cover the expensive lab costs involved in extracting and sequencing DNA from remains whenever a qualifying agency is unable to afford them. DNA Doe Project raises funds through tax-deductible donations and uses the site Tiltify to make it easier for influencers and streamers to incorporate fundraisers into their social media accounts." We've spoken with representatives of DNA Doe Project on the podcast before. They've been kind enough to step in and explain aspects of genetic genealogy to us when we've asked, but we've never gotten a chance to dig into the organization itself. And because investigative genetic genealogy is a growing interest among anyone who cares about resolving cases, we thought it was time to feature them and some of their work. There is much more to investigative genetic genealogy, or IGG, than we can cover here in a single show, but we think you'll find this conversation to be really fascinating. We spoke with two representatives of the DNA Doe Project. First, there's Karen Binder, who works as Director of Education and Development at DDP. She also serves as a team leader and volunteer genetic genealogist with DNA Doe Project. Our second interview participant was Megan Pasika. They have volunteered with DNA Doe Project since 2019, and they currently serve as a team leader and researcher on multiple cases. With so many different individuals and organizations doing investigative genetic genealogy, we started by discussing what differentiates DNA Doe Project from a for-profit organization. Throughout these episodes, you're going to hear us use the acronym IGG. As a reminder, that's simply shorthand for investigative genetic genealogy. So, what makes DDP different from a for-profit investigative genetic genealogy company? You're a nonprofit, so that must tie in directly to the goals of the organization, right?
This is Karen. In a nonprofit model, all of the funds earned by our company go back into the company. So we don't have any shareholders or investors. All of our earnings go to casework and program costs. So for example, if we bring in more donations this year than we did the year before, the only thing that does for our company is it helps us to take on more cases than we did the year before. So there's no investors to answer to, and that makes it so that we're able to really stay focused on our mission and vision and not go outside of the scope of our mission. What we really want to do is identify these John and Jane Does and resolve their cases.
Can you tell us how DNA Doe Project functions in terms of how its services are offered? What can DDP do and not do? What are the parameters for accepting a case, and how do cases come to you?
This is Karen. Typically, cases are referred to us from the law enforcement agency that has jurisdiction over the case. So, for example, unidentified remains cases that are owned by an agency or a medical examiner's office, that agent will contact DNA Doe Project to refer the case for IgG testing. And then our case manager and lab, our director of lab and agency logistics, will help shepherd the lab process and the case management process so that our team of genetic genealogists can take on the case. There are a few restrictions to the types of cases that we take on. For example, we don't take cases of neonaticide, where the objective is to identify the infant's mother for prosecution. So that's one thing that DNA Doe Project does not do, although they did recently change their policies and are taking some child and infant cases now. That's one thing that they don't do. Additionally, we get contacted a lot about suspect cases and missing persons cases. Those are outside of our scope and outside of our mission, so we cannot assist with those.
This is Megan. Exactly what Karen said. Also on the topic of neonaticide, GenMatch did also recently, a few months ago, revise their policy to limit the types of cases where there is infant and child death involved that their database can be used for. So there is a component to the use of GenMatch, not just with us, but across the board for anyone doing forensic genealogy. They cannot use, for example, GenMatch to identify fetal tissue. Essentially, what GenMatch is trying to do is they're attempting to limit the use of their database in terms of identifying potential miscarriage victims. The fetal remains can end up in things like the sewage system. And sometimes those remains are recovered by law enforcement and parents are unidentified, and thus the fetal tissue is unidentified.
So, just to underline what Megan explained there, this is not just a policy of DNA Doe Project, but of GenMatch, which is one of the two public DNA sites that may be used by law enforcement. But you won't be able to see that specific policy as a regular user. It's a terms of service aspect of GenMatch Pro, which is the portal through which law enforcement cases are submitted. Regular folks like you and me, we use the normal GenMatch interface. When you get your DNA results from a site like Ancestry or 23andMe, you can download them and then upload the raw file to GenMatch. We've discussed this on the show before. When you create an account and are assigned a kit number, you opt in or opt out of law enforcement use of your DNA. This is for perpetrator cases. Unidentified decedent cases are no longer subject to the opt-in for law enforcement use, though the kits that are prepared for unidentified decedents still must be uploaded through GenMatch Pro and follow its standards, which are different than for regular consumers.
So when we talk about investigative genetic genealogy, I think that all of us can agree that the topic has absolutely exploded over the past few years. How has DDP grown and changed since its inception?
This is Karen. We've really grown and changed so much since we started out. So as you recognize, Laura, when we began, we only had a handful of volunteers. We operated out of very small systems, communicating online. We only had 4 cases in our first year. And now we're nearing our 200th case, our 100th solve. And with those many dozens of cases in the works, we need more structure in place to handle the workload. So we've sort of learned by making mistakes over the years. To give an example, there were times that we had so many cases actively being worked, and some of them were slower to progress than others. So from time to time, agencies would go for a long time without an update on their case. Sometimes agencies would be upset by that. And so over time, we recognized that we needed to have a case manager in place to ensure that agencies were frequently updated on the status of their cases. So that's really the biggest change over time, is adding those structural elements in place. So that includes our case manager, our director of lab and agency logistics, my role, which is director of education and development. We also have a director of IT and security and a finance manager and a media director.
So you mentioned caseload. How many cases in general are the volunteers working on at one time?
This is Karen. It's really different for each person how many cases they might be working on. For me, I am the team leader of about 7 cases right now, but those are all in various stages of activity. Some of them are more difficult cases where we're really waiting on new matches to make any progress in the case. People of Latin American heritage, for example, who have a top match of around 30 centimorgans. And some of them are very active cases that are probably going to be resolved within the next few days.
Karen just mentioned a centimorgan. That's the major unit of measurement discussed in investigative genetic genealogy. According to FamilySearch.org, a centimorgan is, quote, what experts use to describe how much DNA and the length of specific segments of DNA you share with your relatives. These shared segments are divided up into centimorgans. The more centimorgans you share with someone, the more closely you are related.
And we're going to talk more about this later, but I just wanted to note, Karen, you mentioned a 30 centimorgan match. That's about the threshold, right? For a low match where you guys can work?
Yes, I would say about 20 to 30 centimorgans is really the lowest workable match. I usually use the number 20, and that's what we use in our public spreadsheet data. We have a spreadsheet that gets updated every month, and it talks about the top matches in each case. And one of the things that we track every month is how many matches over 20 centimorgans does that case have? Because we consider 20 centimorgans to really be the threshold of workable matches. However, even if a John or Jane Doe has a handful of matches that are just over 20, that's not going to do a lot for us unless there's very good triangulation. And there are a lot of factors that need to be in place for that to result in a solve. I have solved two cases with the top match between 30 and 40 centimorgans, but those were cases of European John and Jane Does where there was very good triangulation on the matches that they did have, and additionally, excellent representation of the population in GEDmatch and family tree DNA. Whereas in, for example, Latin American case, you're going to have only a handful of DNA matches between 20 and 30 centimorgans, very low representation of those populations in the databases, and likely poor triangulation as well.
This is Megan. I have a running count, and I should look this up, but I think I've worked on about 18 or 20 cases since I've been with DDP, and I've served team lead on about 7 or 8 of those. And like Karen, they are in various stages within the process. Some of them are long-haul cases where we're still working on the trees, but really we're waiting for a big break in the case. And a lot of times with those cases, we're going to be pushing for more publicity on the case and encouraging people in certain communities to upload. And that has heavily rewarded us in the past with doing that. And that's something we can talk about at length later. Other cases, we're waiting on the agency to make the call to announce that we've solved the case. We never push an agency to announce before they are ready. That is fully in their hands. Essentially, we give them that investigative lead and we allow them to follow up on it in any way that they need to so that they can get comfortable enough to close that case.
So is there a common DNA Doe Project case? Meaning, are there factors you see in cases that are brought to you by law enforcement, by medical examiners, similarities that connect them in some way?
This is Karen. I would say that the main factors that a lot of Doe cases have in common is that many John and Jane Does come from difficult backgrounds. I'll point out that most of the cases that I've solved are Jane Doe cases, and I've noted that many of them worked as sex workers during their lifetime. Many of them came from households that were non-traditional. Maybe there was an element of a difficult home life. I've also seen adoptions and misdistributed parentage events in their family trees. You know, sometimes when I'm looking at a case, I feel almost like I've read this same story before because there are so many factors that they have in common.
This is Megan. I've seen similar patterns in my cases. A lot of the does, a lot of the time, are not reported missing. And that can be for a variety of factors. It doesn't mean that the family did not miss them and did not care about them. Every single case I've worked that has been far from the case. The family was actively looking for and wondering what had happened to this person, sometimes decades before. They may have just not had the resources to report them missing. There may the police back in the 70s or 80s may not have been willing to take a missing person's case. Perhaps there were jurisdictional issues. Police were treating it as a voluntary missing and not an endangered missing person. There are a variety of factors, and I know you've talked about those in the past in your podcast, but I would say the vast majority of our cases, I bet we could count on maybe one, maybe two hands, the amount of people who are in NamUs who happen to also be does. The sad reality is that a lot of these does are from difficult backgrounds. They may struggle with difficult home life or addiction. They may be estranged from their family. And that just makes it all the more difficult to identify the person if they didn't have as much of a paper trail as another family member who may have been settled and may have been housed.
So to kind of speak to some of the points that we've brought up in the last few questions, I'd like to ask you two things. First, I'd like to ask you about solves. And I'd like to ask you first about some of the quickest solves you've made at DNA Doe Project and the factors that made them as such. And then I'd like to talk about some of the most difficult solves and what the factors are there.
Just a note, in Karen's answer to this question, you'll hear her reference a former Jane Doe decedent known as Buckskin Girl. She was identified as Marcia King in April 2018. She was nicknamed Buckskin Girl by investigators because she was found wearing what's been described as a fringed jacket or poncho that was made of buckskin. Karen also mentions a decedent formerly known as Lime Lady. She was so called because her remains had been covered in lime, probably by a killer who wanted to destroy the evidence. Instead, she was better preserved. Lime Lady was identified as Tamara Lee Tygard.
This is Karen. In my cases, the fastest solves that come to my mind, first would be Buckskin Girl. I was assigned to that case, but I live on the East Coast, whereas many DNA Doe Project members live on the West Coast and stay up later than I do. And I remember that case, the matches had not yet populated when I went to bed that night. And then when I woke up in the morning, it was solved because they solved it in less than 4 hours. So that was one of the fastest solves. Another that comes to mind for me is the victim of John Wayne Gacy, whose name is Francis Wayne Alexander. It took us about 8 hours to solve that case, which was announced 1 year ago today. Another that was very fast was Lime Lady, who took us about 24 hours to solve, and Phoenix Jane Doe 2004, now known to be Ginger Bibb, that was about a 48-hour solve. In all of these cases, the common factors were that they were of European descent, and their families had been in the United States for quite some time. So no recent immigration, no underrepresented populations in those cases, and no family tree anomalies either. So those are all the factors that led to quick solves on those cases. My more difficult cases, the first one that comes to mind is Apache Junction Jane Doe. This case I've been working on for over 4 years now. She's a young girl that was found deceased in Apache Junction, Arizona in the early 90s. And the reason why her case is so difficult is because she is half Hispanic, one quarter German, and one quarter African American. We have solved her paternity, sort of. It turns out that her biological grandfather was an American serviceman who had a baby with a German woman when he was stationed overseas. That baby was given up for adoption along with a full brother. We identified through DNA the full brother to Jane Doe's father, and we asked him to upload to GEDmatch, identifying him as a full uncle to Jane Doe. Unfortunately, even though we were able to solve the adoption situation, we don't know what Jane Doe's father's adoptive name is or where he was adopted out to. And then on her other side, she is full Mexican. And so she has very distant matches on her Mexican side of her family, which makes this a long haul case. So we're still doing a lot of outreach to the public, trying to get more people of Latin American descent to upload to GEDmatch and Family Tree DNA. And that's one of our cases that is really long haul.
This is Megan. My quickest cases have been solved. I think one of them was solved within the hour or within 2 hours. Sometimes we get really lucky and we have a really fantastic match or set of matches to work with right away. Other times we aren't so lucky. I have a case that I have been working on. It was the second case that I ever started working on at DNA Doe Project in 2019, and it is still an ongoing case. And that is the case of Jonesport John Doe 2000. He was found floating in the Atlantic Ocean just off the coast of Maine in late 2000. He was found to be about 60 years old. He is of 100% Ashkenazi Jewish descent. And because of that, his matches are heavily endogamous. His matches that for someone of straightforward, non-endogamous European descent, they would be really good Centimorgan numbers you'd be looking at. For Jewish endogamous populations, those numbers are more representative of like a fourth or fifth or sixth cousin, but his case is very not straightforward. A lot of people that we believe are in his more recent family did die during the Holocaust. There are entire family branches in his matches that were murdered during the Holocaust, and their records also often don't exist, especially death records and later family life records. So his case has been ongoing for a very long time, and we're just hoping for better matches to work while we try to work with what we have. Again, that's another case where recent immigration comes into play. We're unsure if he was an immigrant himself or the son or grandson of immigrants, but in any case, it's going to make that case a lot more difficult to work.
So Megan, you mentioned endogamy. Could you remind our listeners what that means?
Endogamy means that you have the same families marrying one another over multiple generations. It can also mean that someone shares the same set of ancestors in their family tree more than once. For example, I have a branch in my own family tree where two first cousins married each other. And this was back in the late 1700s. And because of that, I appear more closely related to people on that side of my family tree as someone from other branches of my family tree, because I simply had twice as much chance to inherit that DNA as I did from other branches of my tree. So it complicates things in the way that when you combine endogamy with large families, you now have a huge amount of people to sift through looking for your doe.
And to my understanding, this is something we can see a lot in perhaps a region that is somewhat isolated or maybe a small town even.
Absolutely. We sometimes see a subset of it called the founder's effect, which essentially means, for example, part of my family branch were some of the first Americans to settle in the Sabine Parish area, East Texas, in the 1820s and 1830s. So because of that, it was a very small subset of about 500 or so Americans. And because of that, I'm related to the vast majority of people from that area. You see it also with Cajun families who tend to share similar Acadian roots.
Just a quick note. We've discussed this on the show before, but just to be clear, endogamy is something that is very common in many communities all over the world and can be seen in every region in the U.S. For instance, Julie Doe, who we've covered on the Fall Line, has a tree with some endogamy. Her strongest matches are in the southeastern U.S. I am actually a very low match for her myself, something I discovered when Karen ran my kit against Julie's in June. Next time, you'll hear more about why she did that and about how you can have your DNA results compared to the decedents who the DNA Doe Project are working to identify, and much more. Be sure to listen tomorrow for the second half of our interview. We are supportive of nonprofits like the DNA Doe Project that are working to raise money for cases, and we're so thankful to Karen and Megan for joining us today. We'd like to ask our listeners to join us in donating to one specific DNA Doe Project case. As Karen told us, cases without forensic art are much less likely to receive funding, and the Pima, Arizona case we're about to tell you about has only reached around 10% of its funding goal. We asked DNA Doe Project which case they'd like our help with, And they chose this particular case because it's received the least funding to date. The case description per DNA DOE project is as follows. They're using the case designation Florence Junction Clandestine Grave, Jane Doe, 1988. Quote, on June 28, 1988, the decomposing remains of a white woman were found partially buried in the desert in Pima County, Arizona. The area is located approximately a quarter mile west of US 79 and south of Florence Junction. The woman is believed to have died within the previous year and was buried in a clandestine grave. Authorities estimate that this Jane Doe was over 50 and about 5'3", with medium-length gray hair with traces of blonde. A pink denture with porcelain teeth was found with her remains. She had suffered from osteoporosis, compression fractures, and a curved spine that would have caused her to have a hunchback posture. Her clothing was described as a floral dress or housecoat with snaps up the front. She was also wearing a white bra and white size 8 underpants. Please, join us in donating to this case. You can find a link in our profile. And if this description sounds at all familiar to you, please reach out to the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner at 520-724-8600. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us over on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Millbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue that work, and we're so grateful. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We also have occasional video live streams and blogs, which all patrons can enjoy starting at just a dollar. If you prefer Apple Premium, we've begun that feed as well. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turney. As of November 2022, our monthly donation is going to Season of Justice to support their testing and family grant initiatives.